corrida. Boa tarde a todos. Desculpe, meu português é muito ruim, então eu vou falar em inglês. Desculpe. Próximo ano, talvez em português. Ok? Not a problem? Ok. And actually, for me, anytime you have a question, you know, I guess they say, you know, I speak for a while and questions at the end, but I don't mind if we get interrupted. I think it works better that way. So please do, if you like. One of the things that I really wanted to, this is something everybody here knows better than I, but too often when we think about learning, we actually confuse ourselves in thinking about teaching. And we stop thinking about what do we do when we want to learn something ourselves. And for me, the free software community is one of the best examples of really rich, powerful learning that a lot of the things that we say in educational systems we're having trouble with at this time are actually things that have been solved inside the free software community for the benefit of the free software community. So we could say there's actually really deep thinking about learning, not by thinking about, oh, I'm going to teach this, but we're trying to learn to do something better and better ourselves. It's something that's distributed around the world. It's something that people take on their own to do. It's very definitely learning by doing, and especially what we often designate in terms of learning by constructing. Hear the noise in the back, it's amazing. I don't know if you can hear both talks at the same time. But, so, it's really one of the best examples that we have about learning that really functions extremely well and has really grown to a very large scale and is something that produces something very high quality that people really do and has brought real service to the world. So these are certain kind of principles about learning that for us we want to make sure winds up in the environment for children as they're learning. Not to say that they're going to make, you know, participate in writing some software for an operating system or anything like that, but the principles are very effective in how the free software community is so, you know, was able to grow, but also is of such high quality. It's not like, oh, bad things are happening. It's actually really good things are happening because of the way that it works. Often, when we think about using it for education, you look at what free tools are people creating that aren't just tools for programming, but are actually ways that we might think about using software in education. And all too often, this winds up just making a free, open version of some really poor quality educational software. And it's the opposite. So here in our own lives, we're learning, we're doing, we're applying something in a very rich way. But then when we think about how do we make free and open materials available for learning, we don't do the same thing. And we often just follow up with other you know, software that already exists, no matter how bad the software is and how foreign it is from how we think about learning. For us, coming from the lab that I worked in for many years, we really deeply believe in the power of computational thinking, of computation, and that there's certain problems that using computation to think about that no other media or no other approach gets you the same thing. So these are things that are abstract or highly complex or highly interconnected, highly networked, very dynamic. We see a lot of things with children having trouble learning in mathematics, in sciences, in various forms, that you say it's not necessarily because the concept is hard, and it's certainly not because the child is incapable, but it's really we're not putting the right tools in their hands for understanding these things. So this is what we try to do in terms of what materials and computational and digital materials we try and put in children's hands in order for them to do things. One thing I was mentioning with a good friend in the front, when we did a project, I'll show a little bit of it was called Cidade Que a Gente Quer. We did it with the municipal schools of São Paulo. We also did it with Fundação Bradesco and schools around the country. And the overall goal was to have children take their community and envision it in the future. How would they like it to be? What dreams do they have? How could something be much better? what problems exist now and what ideas they have for certain kind of solutions. Always when we've done projects with children, we've always tried to have them document their work, keep a kind of designer's notebook. And, you know, and I was never able to get any child to do this. It was kind of like documenting your own code, right? You know it's important, you know it's good, but maybe it's, you do it after you're finished, and maybe you don't because you don't have time or whatever. And we always tried to have it for the same reason. But it was really hard to get people to do it when we were trying to have them use paper and pencil to write it. And it was first here in Brazil where we first had some really cheap digital cameras. And we said, document your work by taking pictures, recording your voice, writing a little bit of text, putting something in. And everybody did it. Now, it's hard to say exactly why that was. I mean, I don't know that it would even be the same now as people are more used to being able to take pictures immediately, but probably it will be. By expressing things in a digital format, by using image, it was something that was much more in the life of these children and something they were actually really quite fluent with. And it's another example of which tools that we think about. Obviously, there's tremendous benefit to literacy, to developing the ability to read and to write. But it's not that making marks on paper is the real essence of what we're trying to do. The real essence of it is in conception and communication and understanding of ideas. And this way we saw that when they were doing things in mixed media, some things in image, some things with voice, some things with text, a lot of the problems, certainly in motivation, but also in the conceptualization and the communication of ideas, came through much better. With my youngest son, at one point some years ago, we decided we'd just build his own computer for playing games. Go to store, we have the advice from an expert, it really works well, we go back. What's the first thing he does, which I didn't think about being way too old? First thing he does is he goes to YouTube to look at videos for the different ways of constructing. So the using image for these things as opposed to just text instructions was so much more powerful. So this is what we try to get into the life of a child as they're trying to learn. Which media and which tools can we put in their hands so that they can learn the most? So this is from work that we did in Thailand. And I wanted, even though this work that I'm showing, it started 1997, but in that way it actually almost makes it more powerful. We had a project with Thailand starting in 97 to look at really improving the educational situation in the country, in particular in the rural areas. It was looked at as really problematic that they said, oh, the families don't care about education, the teachers are of very poor quality. So the idea was like, in which ways could we start to change this? We worked in a while just by taking ideas from Paulo Freire, and we said, when we talked to the parents in the rural areas, we would ask about education. They wouldn't say, oh, we don't care. But they would say, the school doesn't give us what we need. And so there was a mismatch of using this very standardized curricula that just said, if this is Tuesday on, you know, June the whatever, then this is what we're going to be teaching to every child, no matter what. And schools were formed in a time when we had a different view of the mind and a different view of learning. We didn't have the same tools that we have available now. And we also had different forms of organization that we thought about for very large organizations. So here's where we want to think again from free software. You can be working on your own, you're working at your own pace, you are going to be learning, you care about what you're doing so it's high quality, and you can be distributed wherever. So a lot of the problems that exist for children's schooling don't really exist in society. It really exists because of what tools we're putting in children's hands and our form of organization. So we worked for a while with people from the Ministry of Education, from a lot of community groups, and they continued this. So this story is actually from some project that we directly had nothing to do with. This was purely done by people there in Thailand. So this is north central Thailand. It's both agricultural and very industrial. So you'll have these little poles, heavy industry, concrete, and different, some, you know, auto. There's a part of the country that makes all the disk drives. This isn't that part. But in this area, you see, it's really quite beautiful, but there's a huge problem. Okay, that they actually still choose to burn the forest. And it's been illegal for a lot longer than the time that we've been in Thailand, but people would still do it. So they're making kind of local decisions and doing it. And when it's just one village doing it, it's not the worst thing in the world. But when you have thousands of villages doing it, it's actually a huge problem. It's a huge problem even locally because of the problems from deforestation, problems from them losing topsoil, problems from them there's flooding, problems when the fire gets out of control during very dry periods. And so, you know, it's actually a huge problem. But locally, in the village, they're making that decision because it makes the most sense for themselves. They're clearing land for their farming, they're chasing animals that they hunt. The income level in the village is actually very low. And so these are things that are important. They also had the belief that there was a certain type of vegetable that would only grow after the forest has been burned. And so, this was the situation. This is what it leads to, is that so during the rainy time when they get the monsoons, you have tremendous problem from flooding, from the loss of topsoil that degrades everything there. You see, this is what it looks like in the dry period because they basically get rain only during one season of the year and then it finishes. So what did they do? This was a project, well, the first project that they did was super interesting. Every family in this particular village was in debt. When you're in debt, you're in danger of losing your land. Access to funds in the rural areas is actually really difficult, so they pay really the highest interest rates. It's really criminal. But they don't really have much power. This is what happens. When they discovered that every family was in debt, the first work of the school was to, they called the Debt Project, where they went with every family, even some of the families that couldn't read and write, and they started to take an account, where does the money go? What do we spend on? When do we earn? Being a rural area, they basically only earn at the times of the years when they harvest their crops and can sell what they have. But they also saw that, so during the whole year, they're just getting further and further in debt. But then they started to get more close on, well, where is the money going? And so the first thing they were able to do is to see that they were all spending high prices by buying certain things in small quantity. And they formed some village co-ops in order to really start to change it. This program only started by the idea of how can they use the technology. But because they were using the technology as tools for understanding and improving life in their community, it became very different. Because the level of literacy and education in this village was actually relatively low, a lot of the information or ideas exist on the web of things that you could do and should do. But it's not the kind of thing that enters into the thinking and the practice of people because they aren't really used to working with technology in this kind of way, especially then when this started about 13 years ago. So they were able to first really change the financial situation in the village, and this was taken as the learning project. Now, when you think about the kind of mathematics that we teach in school, what Paulo Freire would call it was a kind of banking approach. We teach something, you say, kids say, why do we have to learn this? We say, you're going to need it later. But the idea is that they put it in the bank and they withdraw it at some point in the future. But for the most part, this isn't necessary. And really, for the most part, we teach mathematics that's easy to do with paper and pencil, and not necessarily because it's really good mathematics for learning. If you wanted to ask the question, what foundations in mathematics should a child have? Or what should a mathematics education be now in 2013? You're going to find it's really quite different from the mathematics that we throw at children every year. And so we were in a school day before yesterday. And so for the fifth year, they're looking at mathematics. They're studying fractions. So they're doing manipulation of fractions. Why? If you're doing calculation over it, you'd much rather use decimals. You wouldn't use fractions, except for in something very easy. You know, we teach, though, what you have to do to add one fraction to another. But why? It's a problem of representation. And we use fractions, actually, in school by mixing fraction as a discrete quantity or fraction as a ratio. between one element and another. But this is lost because most of the people teaching mathematics don't think about mathematics in this way and have never really done mathematics for anything interesting. What do we do with children? Well, we want in the very beginning that they're very fast and accurate at calculating. But come on, you know, when you say, why are we doing this? They'll say, oh, they need to know the concept. Well, let's really try to get to understand the concepts in number theory, but not by manipulating things quickly. It's really silly. You look at a lot of the problems that we put at children, bisecting angles, certain kinds of things, the way that we do plane geometry. There's certain wonderful things in that, but it's lost in the mechanics of teaching it, as opposed to the deeper concepts of mathematics that we really want them to learn. We saw in the debt project, though, that all the problems of calculation actually went away really quickly. They were able to figure out what they needed to do, how they needed to do it. They were able to use the computer to do this. And it was a much richer thing because it actually really made impact in everybody's life. They went on from this project to quite a number of other projects, but the first one they did was really to start to study the health of the forest. So when you say, how do you know a forest is healthy? How would you know? And what do you want to think about? There was the issue about burning the forest, and some people had come in and said, we need to really start to change this. But they really wanted to look at how could they get a more sustainable and productive agriculture that didn't rely on pesticides, that didn't rely on burning the forest, and could they do something? But being a village, what was really interesting in this particular place is that all the decisions were made collaboratively, so that they actually worked together. And this actually was, I think, one of the biggest reasons why in this village things went really well, is that they maintained the means for working together. And it's one of the things that we see when we work in rural areas as opposed to urban areas, where a lot of this has been broken down, is that in the rural communities where everybody knows each other, they still help each other, they have a kind of collective efficacy that actually helps things to take root and expand. When we talk to people in the ministry in Thailand, they would think everything about the rural areas is pretty bad and what they lack. But it didn't value what actually really was there and what was strong. So by starting to study the forest, instead of the person that was helping from the ministry saying, well, this is what you have to look at and how do you do it, he made this a collective investigation. How do we know? What do we really see? And it wasn't hard for people to start to look at what's the course of what happens over time. So they looked at when it gets dry, they're starting to, you know, they were able to use the machines that they had and sensors to be able to detect humidity. But then even the idea of humidity, it's a word that we use, but when we measure humidity, what actually are we measuring and how can we do it? It's actually really quite simple. It's something that comes across in science curriculum, but nobody really knows why. We just kind of teach it as a fact or information to be memorized. And again, a kind of historical remnant of education is that so much of what we do was based around giving information about. But now when you have devices and you have connectivity and it's reliable, getting information isn't scarce, it's not hard. The harder part is actually getting the right information and not getting too much information. But we can change the work of school instead of dispensing information and then retrieving it from the student to see did they remember it, to something that's much more valuable, which is actually really doing serious projects, learning what you need to learn in the course of this. So the mathematics of calculation, even some kind of ratios, even some other kind of things, came through in the debt project really well. By measuring and trying to determine health of the forest and what they needed to look at, it came in a very integrated way in terms of what data are you looking at, what data is significant, which data isn't, you know, how do you really start to analyze this and come up with some understanding of what's really going on? And they looked at really interesting things. They measured rainfall during the year. They looked at the leaves that were falling from the trees. They're measuring what plants are growing. They are looking for when fungus is happening. So they really started to have to observe what's really happening. But they had access to real expertise that didn't live there in the village, but lived elsewhere. So often the problem is that we have a vicious circle in education where a teacher probably received a very poor education themselves, certainly in mathematics, probably in science, probably also even in literacy, in reading and writing. Then they are, if it's locally bound, then that's going to be the upper bound of what the child is going to be able to learn too. But when we were able to get them connected to people with real expertise on the problems that they really cared about, they learned these kind of things and were able to put it into use much quicker. So the idea of using the technology, you see, is in a different way. Here they're using it as measuring devices, then they're using it to be able to analyze and think about the data, to understand why you graph certain kinds of things, to really start to look for what are patterns, how do you make an analysis, how do you back this up, and then how do you even communicate your idea of what's going on there. Because they really cared about this and it really impacted their lives, the accomplishment and the level of achievement was far beyond what the kids in this kind of village or in that school for years and generations had ever been able to do. So you saw also that they were working really in a very collaborative way. In this case, it's actually the woman at the bottom was at that time the village leader. But you see, it's the kids that are the ones that are really helping, but they're working collaboratively on the project. And so this idea of like, oh, well, we have to put all the 8-year-olds with the 8-year-olds and the 10-year-olds with the 10-year-olds, and we're teaching them that, is also a historical remnant. If you were trying to say, I'm going to build this new piece of software, nobody said, well, you can only work with somebody that's your age. You would think this is nonsense. Yeah, but this is what we do to kids. But again, it's because when school was organized around delivering information, it was more efficient that way. But if you're saying we're trying to make something more efficient for learning, and that the learning is something actually empowering to the child, then you can really think of very different kind of set ways of organization. So in this case, they all work collaboratively on these kind of problems, not everybody doing the same thing, but even starting to understand how would you divide up a problem such that you make a complete whole. So again, you see this in software development projects, you may be spread out, but this is the idea. Not everybody writes the same piece of code for the same thing, because then you never get anywhere. So you take a bigger problem, you discuss how to do this, you divide up the kind of problem, people see what goes out, and through this process, you always learn that how you looked at it in the beginning is not really the way the problem was and isn't what you had to do to solve it. By entering into school projects in the same way, it's obviously much more impactful and better preparation for the kind of way that we really live our lives afterwards. We're not just sitting them down, you have to learn this, everybody has to learn it this way, here's how it goes, everybody does the same thing, and we don't know why we're doing it. Well, it really can be different. Okay. So they learned actually through some things. You see, this is actually a very kind of appropriate technology solution for the problem with the rain. Because they're on the hillsides, what they did was that, you know, as the water's running down the hills, they set up these series of what are called check dams. So you see, it's just rocks, bamboo, some wood, and a little bit of cement. And basically, as the water's coming down the hill, they have a lot of these check dams, and that holds the water into the forest much better. So instead of the water running down, which was especially bad after burning, they saw that, no, they can actually do this, and then this kept the water into the woods for the whole year and kept things going. They mapped this out, they planned this way, and then they realized that they actually started the wrong way. So it's a kind of debugging process that's actually very rich in terms of human problem solving, but it's something we almost never do in school. In school, you're always afraid to give the wrong answer, but the best learning happens when we're wrong. What they learned and where a lot of the physics came from is that they started because it was easier to build from the bottom up. So they said, we'll put the first check dam at the bottom, then move on up. So what happens? Water's coming with such force by the time it's getting down there, the dams actually didn't hold. This was something that they learned because rainy season's once a year, so it's a kind of yearly learning cycle. But they really started to understand a lot more kinds of things on the very specific kind of ideas for, like, why would that be the case and how much pressure would you need to be able to withstand, but also for, you know, just these ideas of, like, how do you go about solving a kind of problem, determining what's wrong. So that's another picture of check dam. They were able to create this reservoir, actually, by the second year. And so I don't have the picture in this presentation, but what you see is then they were able to actually use some of the land that's on flatter ground, create an irrigation system of their own, and basically use this. So they increased the income of the village substantially by having enough water, because they used to run out of water by the end of the year. They had to figure out a way of, like, how do you do irrigation, based on what you're going to plant, you know, for how much acreage, how much water you're going to need, how much is really going to be there, how much rain do we get on average, how much is going to seep into the ground, how much is going to evaporate during the year. You know, they were able to actually do these kind of calculations. So it's, again, putting the mathematics to use, because they really had a means to know how. And they were learning things so much faster, because we have a view from our schooling that certain things take a certain time to learn. But that's flawed, because if we're learning and don't know why, or we're not applying it, or it's abstract, or we don't see the value, or we're kind of just doing it by being passive, this actually, of course, it's going to interfere with the speed and the depth of learning. Changing things to real problems actually makes things much easier and changes our whole calculus of how long do we think things are going to take. Oh, now they're also bottling water. So they've used that reservoir, and they now also have another, they generate their own electricity sufficient for the village, and they also now purify enough water that's for drinking. Now again, this village is really unique, because people from the outside will have a view, but because they really have a sense of collectiveness, they have a sense of, you know, living in harmony with nature, it's a place that, you know, it's actually a very Buddhist place also. It has a lot of wonderful qualities that, instead of thinking of, oh, we can now sell this water to the neighboring villages, or our surplus electricity will sell, they actually choose not to. They say, we're doing fine, we don't want to take more, we give this stuff to them as an example of what they could do also. And, you know, so it's pretty amazing. This is something I'd written about in the past. It's a one-person tractor, which is kind of a local rural invention of taking a very simple kind of inexpensive diesel motor and using it for multiple things. So they use it for the tractor, it also pumps the water, it can, you know, run the rice mill. And you see a system of pulleys that are able to do this. And one of the things we had noticed in the past was that here we had a lot of teenagers, young adults, that were able to really, when we brought in the computer and said we're going to start to program, we did things with physical devices that, not robotics in the anthropomorphic sense, but using robotic materials to accomplish real tasks in more autonomous ways, and programming that, we saw some of these kids who had very little formal education, and that formal education was very poor quality, do really well with this. It was astounding. You say, how do you account for this? And when, upon investigation, we saw almost all of them would hack engines, because they, or some type of motor. And they didn't ever have the right part if something broke, so they'd have to make a part. So they had a kind of systems understanding, but they had, in the most positive sense of the word, a real hacking spirit, that if something breaks, I'll figure out a way to make it work. I might not have the right tool. So you see a lot of kludges, right? You say, oh my God, is this going to break? But it really goes. But the understanding of how do you do diagnosis, how do you understand things by system, how do you like have that right spirit to dive in, this they really had in abundance. So again, we're starting to see all these things in rural areas that at a governmental level, they say, this is lacking, that's lacking, this is no good, this is bad. But you actually see tremendous strengths that are not only just ignored, but more often, they're kind of squashed. So the hope in what we're doing is that what are the ways that we can rethink the use of tools and technologies for learning that doesn't just try to fit in school as it is, but really try to adapt them, create projects, create new tools, create new environments for an educational environment as it could be. That's much more humane, that isn't just for a few people, for the elite, but is really something, and actually is something that really could have tremendous impact in the world. We deeply view the importance of human development, of having every child, every one of us, maximize their particular development, knowing that it's going to be different, that every child is really different, whether it's even in the same family, let alone across countries. But also to maximize community development, because in Thailand, like in here, because the rural areas became economically not viable, what happens is as soon as people leave, you know, can, they leave. They move to the periphery of the city. It makes both the rural areas and the cities, you know, really, it decreases quality of life in both places. But again, it's not really necessary. If we think about the nature of work now in an era of technology, as we're putting in infrastructure with sufficient bandwidth and sufficient number of devices, again, the calculus really changes about what's possible. So this was a project from Sao Paulo. This is in one of the schools really on the periphery. It's really a lovely project where these guys, you worked at this school. Yeah. They said the biggest problem in Sao Paulo, I know this was like 2002, I think, but I know it's much better now, but they said the biggest problem in Sao Paulo was crime, and as well as transportation. So I know these have to be better. But we said, well, what would you do about crime? They said, well, our parents ride the bus from the periphery into the center of the city to work. It takes 2-3 hours in each direction. The bus is hot, it's overcrowded. They come back, everybody's agitated, and then they drink and they get in fights because, it's the only way to let off steam. So their solution for crime in Sao Paulo was an intelligent bus. Well, what's an intelligent bus? So, well, when the bus is full, it's going to show you. It won't stop to pick up people, it will display. Say, how's the bus going to know it's full? They said, well, someone's sitting in every seat. You say, well, how are we going to know someone's sitting in every seat? And they didn't have an answer. So I said, well, what else can you think about that's like that, that when something's pressed down, you know it? And one of them right away said, oh, it's a keyboard. Take apart it. Well, we worked with a lot of Sukkot, so we work with like all this kind of broken stuff. We thought it was an idea just to reduce cost, which it did. But the better part of the idea was that it made people think of all these very familiar objects, a scale for weighing thing, a keyboard, a clock, all these kind of things. You had to start thinking about what's the mechanism and how does it actually work. So by taking apart broken things, they were able to see mechanism and really start to understand it, take it from one thing, move it to another. So they saw a keyboard is just a bunch of electronic contacts.
It was a kind of empowerment for these kids. I remember the teacher of one of them, she said, oh, he just have bad grades, he's not motivated, but he got deeply in this project. And I think it was empowerment not just for these kids, but for many of other kids in the project of City of that we want, and also for the empowerment of the teachers and the persons involved. It was for me too. A lot of things transformed. It was empowerment. The idea that I have, it was a great project in Sao Paulo.
Yeah,
a great experience.
Yeah, thank you.
And I had an experience. I was a 5 years volunteer of Gems of the Earth. It's a rural telecenter, and we use YouTube. And I remember it was one of the things, I went to the community and there was a problem in the orange plantation. My English is not good. And they showed the problem in YouTube. And my father, he's an agronomist. And he said, oh, I'm going to tell a researcher in Embrapa. And he get a solution. And it was a simple solution. And they resolve the problem, the community. So technology can empower people, I think.
Yeah, technology potentially empowers people when you're using the technology for your purposes, right? The deep idea in free software is that I'm not taking something that's closed, and I can really always appropriate it if I choose to make it the way I would like it to be. Other technologies, say, can be or other uses of technologies are disempowering. When they're closed, they drive the person, they don't give freedom, they don't really support. And so, too often in education, the use of technology is the latter. Partly it's because of lack of familiarity with the technology, and partly it's just because that's kind of been the culture in most schools. And what we would really hope from this community is, because of this expertise in developing with technology, and because of this sensibility for openness, collaboration, empowerment, and in the ways that we use technology to really build things up, thinking socially, What we hope is that using either developing more tools that are used in more empowering ways, so that people construct with the tools, people think with the tools, they design with the tools, they create and express with ideas with the tools. This is what we need much more of, because we actually have very few kind of tools except for programming languages. And of the programming languages that we have that are appropriable for children, either they're for very young children and then they're limited, or they're still too complex because they're really for real developers. And so I think as a goal is like, how do we make better environments for people as they're learning technology that doesn't take the power out of the technology? There's nothing wrong with those tools for very young children. But for children that are, let's say, you want 8 to 15, as they're getting their way up, could we have different environments for certain kinds of investigations, building on top of like the kind of open, like the physics toolkits that exist? You know, can we make more environments that don't just say, we're going to teach you this, or are very closed, or if you look at a lot of the learning object kind of things, they only let people move parameters around and then observe something in a simulation. And our view has always been, no, have them actually program and make the simulation, because by making the simulation, you're going to have to understand the phenomena. So these are the tools that are lacking that we really need. And for those of you, I hope, that care in this area, really starting to develop better tools and better environments that function in this kind of open way. This is really sorely needed. The other thing that's sorely needed is expertise, right? That it's been, the research group I've been part of started in the mid-60s with the idea of children programming computers. And we've been working with teachers all these years, and lots of other people as well. And very strong here in Brazil also, a lot of people doing this with using programming for teaching or for learning. But we haven't really grown in a way that's been able to really make a big difference in bringing computation, engineering, and these kind of things all the way through the school. Most people that become teachers, it's not their background. Many exceptional teachers do wonderful things, and other exceptional teachers, even if they don't learn it deeply themselves, they're open and they support it. The school system in some ways is opposed to it, and that's something we have to agitate for in order to change, but also there's a lack of critical mass of expertise that's accessible that helps people through. Yeah, this was another project in Pantanal where their idea was like they had to cool down the classroom. And so this is where you see we got a couple different sensors for temperature. Yeah, even setting up the experiment, they looked at it's like, what is it that makes you comfortable or uncomfortable? It's more than temperature. There's going to be humidity. You need a control. So if you keep things in your classroom, it's not, if you don't know what's happening outside, you don't know. Then the problem evolved into something. It's like, if we have a few fans, what's the optimal placement of the fans that would cool down everybody in a room? That's a good question. Everybody here has passed physics at the university level, right? Who here knows the answer to this question off the top of your head? Exactly. You know, this is why it's so good. So they looked at us coming from university and they said, okay, you must know the answer to this. And we go, no, we'll have to figure this one out with you, right? And it was great. All right, you have some ideas. All right, heat's going to rise. You know, cross ventilation is good. But it was great. And then so the idea is like run lots of different tests, see how it's going, see what's really happening, and get a better idea. You see there were some windows, but they weren't all the way around. There was a window at the top. So you're thinking, you push the air out the top, you try to do something to draw back in. It was a great project. Even when we got all the data from what's a better placement, what kind of things you could do, and we graphed it out, it didn't feel right. Okay? You could see it, but you really didn't understand it because it was still kind of abstract. Because this was a rural area, there was a place nearby that kept bees and made honey. And so you have the smoke things that you use to chase the bees out so you can collect the honey without getting stung. And so we used that to be able to visualize, we recorded this, to be able to visualize what's really going on with the air, with the fans. And so this was great, except that they said the smoke stayed in the classroom for 2 weeks. But it was really good, but it really was something about how do you really feel something? And one of my students, who's now teaching in Thailand, and he's Thai, but we did a lot of experiments with environments, I'll show you a little bit in a bit, but that were both online and physical at the same time. And we didn't have time during his thesis, but one of the things that we saw is that if you were manipulating a slider, or using a mouse, or using a keypad to change something, how was that different than actually just trying to use your hands for doing this? We found that with a lot of physical materials, and one of the nice things in the robotics is that a lot of the things that were mediated through the computer or onto a visual simulation, you didn't quite feel in the same way. We didn't do enough research on this, but we're really quite, you know, convinced that there's something in making physical materials computational and having access to them simultaneously in both kind of ways. So this was something we did around dance, robotics, and mathematics, because when we did the robotics, we saw that girls in particular wanted to make a robot that would dance with them, or a robotic pet. We did all these boy kind of projects, like robots that play football, you know, robots that throw things very far, robots that do sumo wrestling and push the other robot out of a circle. Well, you know, putting the heaviest weight on top. Yeah, they're great, but then only on retrospect, we said, each one of these is a kind of very, at least in the U.S., a boy-oriented project. But when we opened it up, it's much harder to make a robot that will dance with you in a way that actually feels or appears like dancing, that works according to a rhythm, than a sumo wrestling robot. So we did this. We created an environment. They composed music on the computer. They could put sensors in the environment and on their bodies. They programmed an animation. The music, the lights were programmable, that was superfluous, and they built robots that would dance. We make a server that communicates, and then as they dance, they choreograph the dance, but as they dance, everything dynamically changes. It brought in certain kind of things in terms of animations that really were extremely rich. We're coming into ideas in group theory because of thinking about, you know, the symmetries and different types of symmetries, types of actions where you can take multiple actions but it brings you back to the origin, you know, which kind of things are complementary. In topology, where you say, I'm going to draw a flower and I want this flower to dance with me. And how should different flowers dance and keep their structural integrity while they're dancing, and how do you program that? Boy, it was fantastic. It's something that I went away from when I worked at One Laptop Per Child, but for me, this is really one of these rich areas where you'd say it's much better mathematics than what we throw at children. They really like it. Ideas in aesthetics really come in. Ideas, really rich ideas in all the different fields come in together. This was an intelligent park that they used kind of laser cutters, and there's no 3D printing in this one, but using a kind of fab lab to actually build an intelligent park. We're doing this. The girl on the left is one who did it. That's her little sister. We had an exposition at the end of the year, but we had to really fight because she could use CAD tools, design everything, print the logic onto the, in this case, the basketball court, program everything, yet she had flunked mathematics in school and was supposed to go to summer school. We say, how is this possible that you can do this and you flunk math? Well, she was being taught math in this really ridiculous way, without understanding, in this very kind of disempowering way, that it wasn't the problem, so it was pretty good. This was what I was saying about the physical and things. So it's like, can you program something that's like a inverse pendulum and keep it balanced, or a car on a balance beam, but now you have to do it by programming it. What do you do? It really wound up good. You see, as they start to do it, this was the idea, but they start out very much as a kind of very simple kind of finite state machine with only two basic kind of states, well, four. Right, but this actually fails really quickly because you get into these oscillations really fast, and we almost killed somebody in our lab by flipping the car across the room. Yeah, we can laugh now because there was no harm done. This is how it kind of got started. We're thinking about different representations for the programming as a kind of state machine so that we could say, well, we can actually use, and this is something we started to do with younger children. It's like thinking about in the state, didn't necessarily have to write code in a particular way, but could kind of do this. That eventually wound up in a finer grained way to start to do shading. So it really started to get closer to lots of particular ideas for a kind of representation that would actually function. which then turned out really to be how they actually control landing the space shuttle. That they had come up with something pretty close, obviously not as sophisticated, but it really was the same basic concept. So in rural areas, this is in Mali, in Timbuktu, before the last problems. They don't have enough classrooms. This is really the Sahara that they're sitting on. 99 kids in this class, right? They have no materials. There's a little bit of chalk and slates, a little bit of chalk and slate in the front. And when you talk in the ministry, how are you going to address this problem? What do? You don't have enough teachers, 99 kids in the class. We're saying it's bad with 30, right? You can't really function, and just to do incremental progress is never going to get there. But it doesn't have to be exactly this kind of way. This next one is, this is in Haiti. See, it's the same kind of situation. Oh, that was the attendance board at the school in this is Cameroon, 83 kids in the class, although you see it's a much richer kind of infrastructure. Okay, so this is the project that we're starting on now with Giuliano. We started a new nonprofit, non-governmental organization that we have here. We're starting in the U.S. also and trying to expand it with the ideas that we can take these rural areas and really say we have something really powerful here. Let me say up front, the approach we do with children, as you saw like with São Paulo, it's the same we do everywhere. Because it's based on the principles of each one's going to learn in their particular way. Each one's going to learn best when they're engaged in things they really care about. Each one is going to learn best by doing, by making, and by thinking about what you're doing. And that we can support this, not just with one teacher in one classroom, but now it's how we can use the network to really gain kind of support. So changing the tools, using computation in its richest forms, changing the organizational structure so that not everything is like this kind of, you know, knowledge flows from here, flows to there, goes to the teacher, teacher dispenses information to the child, but that it's much more active construction. And so we take the rural area in this case and say we're going to take things perceived as difficulties and treat them as strengths. So that in the school we're starting in here in this state is that there's 106 children over the 8 years of school. So there's not enough. They have 13 teachers counting the director for the school. It's looked at as this is not cost effective because we want to have, so in a school of 113 or 106, you'd say, well, four teachers, five teachers, that's all you need to keep a kind of cost model. But if you say, well, no, we can mix the kids. They're going to become more autonomous and in charge of their own learning, that they can help and teach each other. They learn by projects. And in this one rural area, it was great. It was a difference. One school that we were at in São Paulo a few years ago, a teacher was not allowed to leave the students in the room by themselves out of fear of what the students would do to the room or the equipment. But here, they leave the children on their own all the time. They're part of the community. There's really this sense of togetherness. And so the children already are somewhat autonomous. So the idea of having them do projects, the projects become richer because of using the technology. This is how we're trying to treat it. And the expertise that's lacking locally will connect this to experts that will be helping from the outside. This idea at the bottom, or MOOPs, all right, big trend in the US is massively open online courses, right? MOOC, right? But there's still courses. So for certain kind of things, you can say it makes sense. Instead of taking your introduction to calculus with 600 other students, and you're there, and there's a lecture, and then you do other things. Oop, okay. Instead of delivering, right, you can do courses like that for freshman calculus or something like that. But for an eight-year-old, it doesn't really make sense. But let's combine them into these kind of projects. So we're doing a lot of, or we plan to do a lot of kind of ecological projects. Study of the environment, study of water, study of different kind of issues. You study this locally, you really do things, but then the data aggregates globally. I've run out of time, I apologize. This is the idea, my email and Giuliano's email at the bottom. We welcome comments, critiques. We love great praise, is always very welcome. But people want to join in or think, and we can really explore what kind of things could be possible. So thank you, and I apologize for speaking too long. And any questions, I'll take down there outside.